In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 315. I'm talking today about education in Western history and the growth of state education and England as a counterexample and what kind of conclusions we might draw, because I happen to be talking about that right now in the course that I'm preparing for the Ron Paul curriculum. As you loyal listeners know, I create courses for that program. I've already done a course on government, which I jokingly refer to as my anti-government course. I've done a course on Western civilization to 1492, and I'm currently working on Western civilization from 1493. And in the course of working on this material, I thought, well, you know what, maybe I think I'll do an episode on this. And in particular, I've just gotten to about the year 1830 in the course politically. I'm just about at 1830, so I'm after the Congress of Vienna and the Napoleonic Wars, and I've been talking about the conservative reaction to the French Revolution. But now I'm taking a break and spending some time on intellectual topics, topics in intellectual history, rather than more and more topics in political history. So, for example, right now, I'm in the middle of spending two lessons on the subject of education. Well, I have 180 lessons per course, 180 videos to make, and I think the growth of state education is a pretty darn important theme in Western civilization, even if it wouldn't normally get the kind of attention I'm giving it in the standard version of the story. So I've devoted two lessons to that subject, one on the growth of state education around the Western world, and the second one on the specific case of England, where education remained in private hands for a very long time, and the statistics in terms of literacy, money spent on education, will probably surprise you. Perhaps not you guys. I mean, you listen to this show, I bet you at least suspect what the answer is, right? I mean, if you don't at least suspect the answer, then all my efforts have been in vain. But I know you guys know where I'm going with this. Then afterwards, by the way, once I've finished the material on education, I'm spending four lessons on classical liberalism as a school of thought. Obviously, you need to know about that if you're going to do a history of Western civilization. So I'm taking four lessons out of those 180 and dedicating them to first explaining what classical liberalism was. And of course, you know, classical liberalism is what we used to call libertarianism, basically. Then in the second lesson on classical liberalism in this course on Western civilization, I'm talking about the ideas of Frederick Bastiat, who would probably not be mentioned at all in the typical Western civilization course. Then in the third one, I'm going to talk about Benjamin Constant, who would likewise be ignored. And then in the fourth one, I'm going to talk about what I'm going to call radical liberalism, again, within the classical tradition. We're not talking about Barack Obama here. And for that one, I'm going to talk about Herbert Spencer, and we're going to read his essay on the right to ignore the state. And then we're going to talk about Gustave de Molinari, who wrote an essay on the private production of security. So very interesting stuff you would not get in a typical Western Civ course, but that's why I'm doing this. I don't want to produce a typical Western Civ course. The internet is lousy with typical Western Civ courses. I want to do an atypical Western Civ course, so that the students will really get exposed to important ideas and history that they wouldn't have any chance of encountering otherwise in any kind of structured environment. So I'm really pleased with that. So anyway, I thought I would just share a few of these points with you guys today. Now, you can read, and I'll link to in the show notes, tomwoods.com/315 will be the show notes page for today. I'll link to Rothbard's essay. It's like a short book, really, on education, free and compulsory. I'll link to that, and you'll find some of this material in there, although not all of it. He starts talking about the growth of state education in the modern West with the Protestant Reformation. And of course, we do see Martin Luther advocating compulsory government education, likewise for John Calvin. And Calvin's ideas are going to have an even more substantial influence around the world than Luther's will. Calvin was a more international figure. He had more international influence than Luther did. And when French Calvinists promote the ideas of public education, they're just carrying on ideas they got from the master. And so, indeed, you do see in part of France the promotion under Calvinist influence of compulsory government education. John Knox in Scotland, who was a Calvinist, although he had arrived at some of the ideas more or less on his own, but nevertheless, he, with less success, tried to promote the idea of compulsory education. And then, of course, don't forget that Calvin has a tremendous influence, the ideas of Calvin have a tremendous influence on the Puritan colonies of British North America. And it's in colonial Massachusetts that we see, for the first time, compulsory government education being promoted. So Calvin has tremendous influence with this. Now, of course, it's in Prussia that where people look to find the first national compulsory school system in Europe. We see it beginning under King Frederick William I in the early 18th century, and it continues under his son, who's known as Frederick the Great. And it's interesting to note, Frederick the Great once said, "The prince is to the nation he governs what the head is to the man. It is his duty to see, think, and act for the whole community." Now contemplate that for a minute when you think about what the motivation might have been for promoting compulsory government education in Prussia. Was it to encourage independent thought among the citizenry? Really? Is that what that attitude on the part of Frederick the Great sounds like? To the contrary, the idea was to get them all to think the same. Certainly not to encourage independent thought. That's the opposite of what the state system has always been about. It's always been about conformity, loyalty to the state, acceptance of the state's morality, acceptance of your rulers. That's what it was about. That's what it's always been about. And in fact, in France, during the French Revolution, there's an effort to try to get compulsory state education going, although without a lot of success, they just weren't able to make it stick. But under Napoleon, they were able to push forward with it more successfully. And of course, Napoleon wanted to use this system as a way of promoting the proper reverence for himself and the kind of respect that he, the emperor, deserved. So as a matter of fact, let me read for you. You won't find this in the Rothbard little book I'm going to link you to. This is a catechism that Napoleon ordered to be used. It became obligatory in 1806, and it's a typical question and answer kind of catechism. And the relevant portion reads as follows. Question: What are the duties of Christians towards the princes who govern them? And what in particular are our duties toward Napoleon I, our emperor? Answer: Christians owe to the princes who govern them, and we in particular owe to Napoleon I, our emperor, love, respect, obedience, loyalty, military service, and the taxes ordered for the preservation and defense of the empire and his throne. We also owe him fervent prayers for his safety and for the spiritual and temporal prosperity of the state. Question: Why are we bound in all these duties towards our emperor? Answer: First, because God, who creates empires and apportions them according to his will, by heaping gifts upon him, set him up as our sovereign, and made him agent of his, namely God's, power and his own image upon earth. Thus it is that to honor and serve our emperor is to honor and serve God himself. Secondly, because our Savior Jesus Christ taught us both by example and by precept what we owe to our sovereign. For he was born unto obedience to Caesar Augustus. He paid the prescribed taxes in the same breath that he said, "Render to God that which belongs to God, render to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar." Question: are there any special reasons why we should have a particular loyalty toward Napoleon I, our emperor? Answer: yes, there are. For God raised him up in difficult times to reestablish the public practice of the holy religion of our ancestors. That's a reference to the Concordat of 1801 that was reached with the Catholic Church after over a decade of turmoil with regard to the relationship between France and the Church. And now back to the Catechism. He restored and preserved public order by his deep and active wisdom. He defends the state by the strength of his arms. He has become the Lord's anointed by the consecration he received from the sovereign pontiff, the head of the Church Universal. Question: what ought one to think of those who fail in their duty towards the emperor? Answer: according to the Apostle St. Paul, they are resisting the order established by God himself and making themselves worthy of eternal damnation. Well, I don't think that's particularly subtle. I think we can see what the purpose of that is. Now, in the wake of Napoleon, with occasional blips here and there, there was educational freedom more or less restored in France until the late 19th century. And by the end of the 19th century, you see compulsory education, state education, provided for all across Europe, everywhere, with the exception of Belgium. But Belgium wound up getting it by 1920, and that was that. Now, I want to turn... Now, by the way, if you were to read that Rothbard essay in particular, I mean, it really strongly suggests what the motivations behind these systems are. It's nationalism, it's loyalty to the regime, it's whatever. It is not, gosh, people really deserve the opportunity to read the great works of literature, or it sure is important for everyone to learn chemistry. That is not what the motivating factor appears to be in these cases. Now, I want to turn to the subject of England, because here, this is a place where education is going to be in private hands for a long time. And the key scholar you want to be aware of on this is a man named E.G. West. Now, we've referred to him a couple times. Those of you who are longtime listeners may actually remember when we've had James Tooley and Pauline Dixon on the show. They were both from the E.G. West Center at Newcastle University in England. Well, who was E.G. West? He was a scholar of education, and his primary work that you'll want to be familiar with is called Education and the State, written all the way back in 1965. And I want to summarize for you some of the points that he makes in that book. He shows that really throughout the 19th century, starting in 1800 and going for decades, you don't start to see government education in England in any real substantial form until about 1870, and even then it's only gradually being introduced. But schooling is going to depend almost completely on private funds, and yet you see a very substantial amount of schooling, and that's particularly noteworthy considering the fact that the Western world was still so poor in the 19th century that a great many children still had to work so that their families wouldn't starve. And so the fact that there is all this schooling is itself very impressive. There was, it's true, less education per child than today, but there was less everything per person than today because it's a poorer society. The relevant metric, it seems to me, is the question of the percentage of net national income that was spent on day schooling of children of all ages. And in 1833 in England, it was about 1% of net national income that was spent on the schooling of children. By 1920, long after schooling had become free and compulsory, free in quotation marks, of course, taxpayer funded, the proportion of net national income devoted to education had actually fallen to 0.7%. Under the government's influence, it had actually decreased. Now, there are a lot of statistics and there's a lot of evidence about how many people were being educated, how many opportunities were available, etc. But by 1870, when government officials looked around at the system around the country, they did not say, well, we're going to need to have a systematic approach with free government-supplied schools. What seems to have happened around 1870 was the conclusion that, well, we need to fill in the gaps. You know, there are some gaps in different parts of the country, and maybe that's the role of government, is just to fill in the gaps. By 1880, compulsion begins to be used, and by 1891, state schooling becomes, quote, free. And the thinking there was, if we're going to force people to go to these schools, then we have the obligation to make it possible for them to attend. But instead of saying, well, we'll subsidize those people who are too poor to attend, they took the opportunity to make education taxpayer-funded and compulsory for absolutely everybody. Let me say something about the work of R.K. Webb, a historian of literacy. According to Webb, by the late 1830s, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of the working classes were literate, which compares well to the world average today, by the way. Also, there was a substantial rate of growth in literacy. And we see this in the fact, for example, that young people increasingly were found to be more and more accomplished than their elders. So, in other words, educational opportunities are spreading. According to the calculations of West himself, in 1880, which was the year that compulsory education became the rule, over 95% of 15-year-olds were literate. And it's interesting to compare that, by the way, with the fact that over a century later, over a century after that, 40% of 21-year-olds in the UK were admitting that they had difficulties with writing and spelling. Now, there's a lot more that can be said here, and of course, West has a whole book on this, but these are very, very relevant considerations, and he says that the introduction of compulsory education laws actually didn't increase the percentage of people going to school, that the figures that appear to suggest this are entirely misleading and basically useless, and he goes ahead, and in my lesson on this, I go through and examine the arguments. But West's book is an astonishing book. In fact, when I had James Tooley on, Tooley said that when he was setting out to do his dissertation work, he was planning to write it against this sort of phenomenon and in favor of, well, you know, government education and you know, the traditional standard view of things that, well, without government education, everybody would be an idiot and there wouldn't, you know, only the rich could be educated and all that. And he said, I read E.G. West's book, Education in the State, and it was like a thunderbolt struck me. I realized that all the assumptions I held were faulty. Like, every one of them was faulty. And I'll link on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/315, to the episodes I did with Tooley and Dixon, in which they talked about the E.G. West phenomenon that was observed in England being replicated now all over the world. All over the world in the poorer countries, we see low-cost private schools popping up on a staggeringly large scale and outperforming the government schools. And the tuition is being paid for by parents. I mean, all the things that we're told can't possibly be done, can't possibly happen, are indeed happening. I think it's fairly typical, by the way, of a lot of what we know about libertarianism and views that libertarians hold, that so very often what people have come to believe is the exact opposite of the truth. And as libertarians, we've almost come to expect that the conventional wisdom on so many important subjects is just so dead wrong, you hardly know where to start with it. So check out the links at tomwoods.com/315 if this general subject interests you. Now, of course, the Ron Paul program that I've told you guys about is it's a K-12 program. It covers all kinds of interesting topics. It's not just history, economics, government, that sort of thing. It's literature, it's math, it's science. It's public speaking, it's entrepreneurship, it's marketing, it's ad writing. Learning how to write a good ad is a very important skill. You will never be unemployed. If you can write good ad copy, you will never be unemployed, I guarantee you. There is always good use for that. So if you are interested in that, by the way, for your children, then by all means, join the program through ronpaulhomeschool.com. That's my unique link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. And if you join through that link, I will send you a special bonus 10-lesson course on the foundations of liberty that's suitable for junior high and above. You just have to write and ask me for it at the contact page at tomwoods.com. But make sure you're joining through ronpaulhomeschool.com. And my first two courses, which are complete, are available if you just want those a la carte and without joining the Ron Paul program. You can get those at tomwoodshomeschool.com. Tomorrow we're going to talk to Bob Murphy, and then Monday, on the eve of the Ross Ulbricht trial, we're going to talk about that case and what exactly is going on, what the significance is. I decided to keep that separate from the discussion of jury nullification. We've got to be careful here. We don't want anybody being accused of jury tampering or anything like that. So we're keeping these entirely separate. But I do want to talk about that because I think it's of importance to libertarians in general. It's not just if you're interested in Bitcoin. It's an interesting case for everybody, and we'll try and talk about that early next week. So, Bob Murphy tomorrow. Show notes page, tomwoods.com/315. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.